Before we get into today's podcast, I want to offer you a powerful free resource. We often hear from listeners looking for answers to those who claim God cannot exist for a variety of scientific reasons. But science actually supports the existence of God, which is why I want to offer you a free download called God's Not Dead. It explores scientifically how our own cosmos points to a creator in three clear areas. Again, this powerful resource is yours absolutely free, so why not download God's Not Dead for free right now at premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. Now, here's today's podcast.
Understand, defend, and share your faith with confidence. This is Unapologetic from Premier Unbelievable.
Thank you for joining us on Unapologetic. I'm Ruth Jackson. And before we hear from today's guest, just a quick reminder to visit premierunbelievable.com for more shows, articles, and resources. And you can also register there for the chance to win a free book. And if you enjoy listening to Unapologetic, then please do consider rating and reviewing it on your podcast platform. But now for today's show. This episode was recorded earlier this year at a live event at Holy Trinity Church Aylesbury in partnership with Aylesbury Vale Youth for Christ. I was speaking to Dr. Miriam Schilling, who has a PhD in virology. And while doing postdoctoral work at Oxford University into how viruses interact with our immune system, Miriam decided to start studying theology, and she is now undertaking a PhD in theology, exploring how what we know about viruses can influence theological discussions.
Just love to know a bit more about your own faith journey. Like, what was your experience of God as a child, Miriam?
So I grew up in Germany, but grew up in a Christian family. It's similar to here. It's a minority of people who still go to church and believe in God. But I grew up in one of these families. And as a kid, I'm not sure where I had that image from, but I always thought, oh, I'd love to do backpacking with Jesus. I always felt like I want to go on adventures with him. And that was very much my childhood me. And of course, life is more complicated than that. And so when I became a teenager, my dad got severely ill for years and years, and it was a really tough time for us as a family. And at school, I got bullied a lot suddenly. That's when everyone hit puberty. And I just had different interests, and that wasn't easy. And so I was going back and forth between being afraid at home of things going worse and being afraid at school of things getting worse. And I think that's the first time I questioned not so much the existence of God, but I questioned whether this God is meaning well, if he's actually the good God that we all get preached about. And that was quite a tricky and challenging situation because my parents didn't have the capacity to talk this through with me for very good reasons. I didn't have any Christian friends because the church that we went to was like half an hour on the motorway away. There was barely anyone my age anyway. And the interesting thing is, because I love studying and I always have, the logical thing for me to do was find a Bible and start reading because I want to know. And I did the worst thing that people would advise you to do is I started and read it front to back. And of course, that doesn't make a lot of sense for many people. And of course, the first half is for most people also not very enjoyable because once you're past the main stories, there's lots of genealogy and like repetition and weird prophets. And I just made it through because I really wanted to know. And it took me a long time. And I think it was until the Second Corinthians where Paul describes how he didn't need much more than God's grace because that's what was strong in him, and like that was God suddenly talking to me, knowing like I know this is really difficult and life is complex and you feel very much out of control because as a human being you are out of control, but that's not the point. I am real, and I hadn't questioned that, and the beauty of God being real is that if he lives in me, there's so much strength in that, and that totally transformed my life. And I can't really explain what happens when God comes into your life other than from going from a very anxious state and understanding how little I'm in control and constantly being worried of things getting worse, back to a state where I was confident, not about myself, but about life, and because I knew there's a God who cares. And it changed me from, I'm an introvert. I like studying, I like being my little tiny study, and people were scary. When I was a kid, I was always worried a bit about conversations. I didn't enjoy phone calls very much, and once I had this encounter with God, I gained confidence, not because I knew that I'm great, but because I knew that he loved me and that he was part of my life. And I went from, I'd like to play theater in school, which is the worst thing you can do when you're afraid of people, to actually playing the main part in the theater production in my last year of school. And that was really interesting because I started to enjoy being who I am, and I started enjoying all these insecurities, not because they're great, but because they're part of life, and I could see God in them, not necessarily saying suffering is great. Of course it isn't, but I could see that God was bigger, and that's something so fundamental to who I am. I think I got a bit scared when I started thinking about studying natural sciences, because in Germany the main opinion was, oh, this will deviate you from God. By the end of this, you will no longer believe in God. And I listened to these things, but I was so keen to study the sciences because nature is amazing. I wanted to know more, that I took the risk. And as you can see, being here today, no, it didn't deviate me. It's a very different discipline, and they have different methods. And I think that conception is a misconception. And I enjoy having had these really deep encounters with God, both on an intellectual, but also on a personal note, and being able to study the sciences, because this planet is just simply amazing.
So your first foray into science was the natural sciences. How did that then lead into studying viruses? Because that's quite niche, isn't it?
It is, yes. And I didn't know much about that when I was at school. Neither did I have any academic background. So my parents didn't even finish their A-levels. They were excited to help me go along with my hobbies, and they were very supportive, but they didn't understand half the things that I was excited about. Didn't know where that would lead to, and I can't blame them. So that was really interesting. I always thought, at least in school, I had a rough idea of, I understand that there's cancer or other diseases, and so what I was interested in wasn't about dealing with the patients and trying to treat the symptoms. What I wanted was to understand how disease forms and what's the molecular basis. I want to understand the reason. So I started studying molecular medicine, which was a new course that tried to combine all the different natural sciences and a bit of the medics, just to give us a glimpse into how to do research on medical issues. And that was really interesting. And there were lots of courses. And yes, there was cancer and immunology. But one year, we had the option of, that was a voluntary thing, and we had a really busy schedule. And I think I was one of the few people who was just curious enough to go there for the first lecture. And I was intrigued because we had three or four different professors who all had a different approach and a different interest in virology. But what they had all in common was a passion to help us understand the molecular details and the beauty of these mechanisms in cells. And they taught us so much about cell biology and about the viruses itself that really intrigued me. And I stayed with them for an internship, and I stayed with them for a thesis, and I stayed with them for my PhD. Slightly
never
different
really
topics.
Left.
and at some point then I left. But I learned so much from them, and it was such a different universe they opened up to me that I really enjoyed that.
So I suppose that's the academic side of things. What does your role as a virologist involve in the day-to-day, in a way that we can all understand what you do?
Sure. Day-to-day, like most people, sitting at a desk reading and answering emails is probably true. Lots of meetings and paperwork. But I think the main thing, so at the moment I'm leading a lab that does virus genomics. So I've come from trying to understand how viruses work and how our immune system responds. Lots of basic research, lots of cell culture in the lab, lots of biochemical assays. And then I started working with the Animal and Plant Health Agency in Weybridge because there's so much interesting detail about the mechanisms of viruses, but because they're part of all the different ecosystems, when I continue basic research, which is highly exciting, I always felt like I'm lacking the big picture of things, and I wanted to see more of the global and world health side of things. I wanted to see how viruses are part of ecosystems, how they change ecosystems. And at least as this agency, we're looking at the broader things across animal kingdoms and plant kingdoms with vets on site and pathologists. And what I do on a day-to-day basis is that the team that I'm now leading, we are sequencing. So we're trying to find what is causing this disease in this animal if there's no diagnosis, but also we are sampling to find out how many viruses actually are there. There's so many that we haven't even described yet, that we haven't even discovered yet, especially in species that are further away from the normal humans and animals that we keep either as pets or that we need as livestock or something. So there's so much virology out there, it's totally undiscovered. And just in recent years, we got the technology, like the sequencing got so much cheaper, we can now actually afford to do this. We have better microscopy options so we can actually see things. So now is the opportunity to understand how many viruses there are. So on a day-to-day basis, yeah, I'm making sure that my team can do the sequencing. Sometimes I do a bit of field work to actually get the samples, or I collaborate with people who do the field work for me, trying to find out what's actually happening in ecosystems. What are the interesting stories in animal and plant kingdoms to say, here's something we need to understand, and then get the samples. We prep them, they go to the sequencing facility, lots of data comes back. So I learned how to do lots of bioinformatics just to analyze what we see in the data, and try to discover new viruses and then make sense of the data.
Just a tiny little bit there.
A little bit.
I suppose for most of us, 2020 was really when viruses became a big part of everyday life for all of us.
Yeah.
What was your involvement in the COVID-19 pandemic? Because presumably, as a virologist, you were just a tiny bit busy.
Yeah, we were all a tiny bit busy. I think I was probably one of the least busy people because I was in a lucky position. So I was at Oxford University at that point, and of course there are so many really good scientists at Oxford. We all had to reduce capacity in the labs because of health and safety. So we worked in shifts around different topics. And in virology, we're also specialized. And before the pandemic, there were very few people doing coronaviruses. So what everyone else did who wasn't specialized in coronaviruses either had to build up the skills to work with coronaviruses or use the existing skills that they had for questions around coronaviruses and adapt protocols. And that's what my lab decided to do. So we were working on the question how things that change in your metabolism, like your inner organs have, for example, low oxygen conditions, and that of course changes how your cells metabolize things and how the cell mechanisms work. And we were basically asking, well, we've studied this for other types of viruses like hepatitis B and C, and then we were like, well, what's the consequence actually for coronaviruses, because they replicate in the lung, that's lots of high oxygen, but once you have an inflammation in the lung, the oxygen levels go down. What happens to things around, like the receptors the virus needs to enter cells? We also asked lots of questions because the second topic we were studying was circadian rhythms. So your body knows the time. Every cell knows the time of day. And according to the time of day, the cell has different functions that are up or down. And that has consequences for every viral replication and your immune response. So we're asking questions around these things. So I was helping with some of these research projects. I stopped mine for a while. I learned a lot more about coding and bioinformatics because I was working from home much more, which means I used that time to learn about epidemiology and global health. There were lots of free courses from really high-ranking universities that I did. I learned how to code, use coding languages like R and Python, just to understand how to analyze data with more and more bigger data sets coming out now. So I learned a lot, helped a bit, in my theology hobby, I was also highly involved then.
Yeah, I was going to say, because I definitely want to talk about that, because one of the things, you'd fairly recently started your theology PhD, which is talking about the impact of viruses on theology. So presumably you were asked a fair few questions as one of the only people who are sort of straddling two worlds. But just before we get to that, one of the things I often think about subjects like virology is it can often sort of be contained within the ivory towers of academia. But how do you ensure that actually what you're learning, the research that you're doing, how does it sort of whittle down and impact normal people like us outside of, I suppose, a global pandemic?
Yes. I think for universities that's quite challenging because they are far away from applications because the main aim is to understand. And so, of course, we try to publish a lot. There's more and more public engagement, hopefully coming out, at least during the pandemic, I think. We were talking a lot more about how does it actually work to do the science? What does it mean? How do we interpret data? And so that was a chance for university to get into that conversation. But of course, that doesn't mean what we learn is actually applied. And now being part of the civil service, of course, we have an interest in keeping the public safe, keeping animals and plants healthy, making sure the environment is safe. So that's a lot more applied by several things. We still publish, which means that all the things that I'm finding, I can share with the scientific community, which is great. The other things, we have like broad collaborations, not just across the disciplines on site. So on site, we now have virologists and bacteriologists, the vets and pathologists. So that's already interdisciplinary, which means the things that I learn, I can tell the vet and the pathologist, and they can make use of that. Or they can tell me what they actually see in the disease and how it's formed. And I'm like, oh, then that's more likely that we find this and we can look specifically around these things. So it helps to have these conversations. And I think the other thing that especially my project that I'm leading was set up to do is to actually engage not just across my little world, but we're working across different agencies, which means that we're trying to collaborate a lot more and have a united approach of how we do virology across the country. We collaborate with the border forces and trying to make sure that we keep the borders safe. And we have an interesting project that tries to collaborate with industry, because for all the poultry and chicken farms, of course, viruses are a threat. And these are excellent places where we have endemic viruses that aren't super dangerous to us, but of course are difficult for the people who try to keep the chicken and the poultry safe. And we can use them to study how endemic diseases spread. So we're specifically sequencing hundreds and hundreds of samples. That's a really expensive project, but trying to map down where we see changes and mutations and what are the pressures, how many animal movements change these things. So that's really interesting. And of course, like further out, we're trying to then engage like startups and more industry with the knowledge that we gain from these big projects.
One area where I've really appreciated your expertise is in that area of the dialogue between sort of theology and viruses. So let's just talk a bit about that, because how did you go from being a virologist to suddenly thinking, oh, I want to study theology? Where did that come from?
That is a good question. It was a random Friday afternoon. I had just started my PhD, and as I said, I like learning and I like studying things. And after years and years of just thinking about the natural sciences, I did miss thinking about broader context of philosophy. I missed working with language. I missed studying languages and history and, you know, all of these aspects. And so one Friday evening in the lab, after just starting my virology PhD, I was like, you know, now that I mainly work and study less, I have capacity. And my church was hosting someone who was a lecturer at one of the theological colleges in Germany for an evening lecture, and then there was a Saturday follow-up thing. And I was like, I want to go there. And I was sitting there and I was intrigued, because instead of exhausting me after a long work week in the lab, I wasn't exhausted, I was actually refreshed, because I had time to think about something else, and I highly enjoyed that. So I went to the Saturday thing, I ordered the study material that he offered, I did that. I emailed him saying, I think this is really fun. Do you think it's doable to do this part-time? He's like, yeah, we have lots of part-time students. Not anyone else was doing a full-time PhD, but that didn't matter at that moment. So I basically signed up for a course. And like while doing my part-time, my full-time PhD, I did over the course of 4 years a part-time degree in theology. When I looked at the subjects that I could take, they had signed me up for Greek, and I'm like, you're nuts, because you know that is probably too much workload. And they're like, no, you'll enjoy that. And they were right, I did enjoy that. And then I did Hebrew after that, because I enjoyed that as well. But it was such a good balance, and to be honest, lots of people that I worked with in the labs, because it's such a challenging environment, and you spend so many hours, like long working hours in the labs. It's not a 9-to-5 job. Many of them have like quite excessive hobbies, just to get them out the lab at some point and to balance that and make sure they, you know, they have something to counterbalance that stressful life. So I had people who do like lots of sports, or who have like amazing baking skills, because they could open a bakery by the end of having studied how to bake properly. And in my case, I just had a theology degree. it's just a bizarre other different type of hobby. And of course, my friends made fun of that, but that's all right.
Well, let's talk about that yeah. Your friends making fun of you, because presumably the whole time you've been in science, you have been a Christian.
Yes.
So how would you respond to people? Presumably you get this quite a lot, the idea that you can't be a Christian and be a scientist, the idea that the two are not compatible.
Yeah, so I had that more in Germany than I have it in the UK, and I think that's also the difference between the countries. So I feel in the UK, people work a lot more interdisciplinary to start with. People have a lot more philosophical debates around certain topics like the natural sciences. In Germany, they're very different universes, and people don't communicate between them. And I think both have a very weird understanding of how they work. So I think lots of Christians and theologians think the natural sciences just try to prove that the world works without God, and that's the premise. No, we don't. We just want to study how it works. There's no premise. Or, you know, that's what we try to do. And I think lots of natural scientists, and I think sometimes rightly so, look at a very narrow-minded theological field where we've basically reduced ourselves to some core methods. And I think that's really sad. And I think we should be braver also as theologians to embrace different questions and to think broader. I think there's good points we can make with the theology that we have. But I think we need to embrace the conversations. And I think because that's not happening in Germany, that's why I got a lot more weird questions around these things from my German colleagues than I have here. I think what it boils down to is that at some point, sooner or later, most scientists would agree that their science can't answer the question if there's a God or not, if they're really honest. And most people that I work with are honest about these questions. And I think that's really cool because I think for a long time we have hyped the sciences so much, or at least the public has. I think we need to be a bit more humble about what it can actually answer. And I think then it's a really enriching conversation. So I think there was always, they made a bit of fun of that, but like they also understood that we can ask some honest questions in theology. And I think sooner or later, because these are people, they have life experiences, they see suffering, they experience death, they have questions about their purpose. They're not different than anyone else. And I think that's an easy route in to explain why the sciences can't answer many of these questions, but theology can, and what's the difference.
Which is why what you're doing is so incredibly important.
We're going to take a quick break now, but if you are enjoying today's show, please do consider rating it and leaving a review on your podcast platform so that other people can discover it too.
You're listening to Unapologetic from Premier Unbelievable.
Since 2016, the Premier Gospel Awards has celebrated the heart and soul of gospel music. Now, in 2024, powered by Compassion UK and live from London's iconic Royal Festival Hall, we're bringing you our biggest and best show yet. Join us on Saturday, September 21st, for an unforgettable night of special guests and live performances from the biggest names in the UK, USA, Africa, and more. Last year's event sold out fast, so don't wait to grab your ticket. Buy now at premiergospelawards.org.uk. The biggest ever Premier Gospel Awards. It's the culture. It's the message. It's the music.
Welcome back to the show. We would love to hear your thoughts and ideas. Do get in touch on social media at Premier Unbelievable. Now let's return to the conversation.
I suppose for a lot of Christians and perhaps scientists as well, one of the big bones of contention is evolution and whether that is compatible with the biblical view of creation. As a virologist, how would you respond to that question?
I think that just because we notice the process of evolution, I think you can't say that there's no God. There are several theological approaches, and some I think work better with evolution than others. But overall, there are people who take evolution seriously. Many of them propose theistic evolution at one point or another, God using that process to create the world. this comes with some problems, but if you go other route, down other routes, that comes with other problems. If you say, you know, God created the world, so if you go the creationist route, well, but we have biological evidence that tells you that there was an evolutionary process. What do you do with that? Or if you go intelligent design, I would say, well, that's a nice approach. And I think, you know, from a Christian perspective, if you come from the premise, I know there is a God, you look at creation and goes like, look how pretty this is and how amazingly it works. Yes, then you would suggest probably that's a sign of that. But if you don't have that premise, just because you look at this amazing complexity, I don't think it necessarily leads to the conclusion that there must be a God. So I'm very much proposing theist evolution, assuming that God allowed a lot of freedom in the process. So that's process theology, and that's quite interesting. It ranges from physicists looking at quantum mechanics to biologists thinking about evolution. And I think there's lots to debate around these topics, and it's quite complex. So I think that's probably how far we can take
well done. You did a really good summary there. One of the questions that often comes up when we're talking about evolution is where the fall fits into that. Because if it was a human fall, how would we account then for the animal suffering that leads up to the, you know, it is good, humanity is good, but there was suffering before, pre the fall. Mm-hmm. Do you have anything to say about that? I know it's a massive topic and you have written about it at great length.
It is a massive topic. I think the main conclusion that I have so far, and I might change my mind or add more nuances to that in the next 10 years, but I would make a difference between moral evil and natural evil to start with. So I think they're two different things, and I think we need to acknowledge them. So thinking about suffering in the animal world, yes, there was suffering in the animal world before human beings came into existence, because there was disease before that. We know that from dinosaur findings. There was definitely viruses ever since we had cellular organisms, all the way through to more complex organisms. So there was suffering. There were earthquakes and volcanoes and all of that. And then the humans appeared. So you can't make humans, whatever happened with humans, responsible for all of that. So I think that's the category of natural evil. I think still in the word fall, it's mainly a relational thing between us and God. I can't explain at which point humans were conscious enough and God assumed we can make these decisions about relationship to him, yes or no. But I'm pretty sure that at some point in history, humans decided to be independent enough, and I'm pretty sure we can call that a fall, but I don't think this is something we should get mixed up with the suffering in a natural world. I think it's a relational thing that comes with moral and ethical issues, and a spiritual divide, but you can't make it responsible for the natural evil, whatever that is.
That's really helpful, thank you. I've got a question here from your supervisor of your PhD.
Oh,
I didn't actually mention who that is. It's the Alistair McGrath. And when I sent him a message about something else and just mentioned that I was going to be interviewing Miriam, and he just sent back the most gushing email about how wonderful she is. And he did actually suggest that I ask you this question. So
right.
If it's a bad one, just blame him. He wants to know, what do you make of Richard Dawkins' assertion that religion is a virus?
That's also fun. I've only written a German article about that.
Okay. If you could translate in your head for us, that would be wonderful.
Yes. I was deeply worried my first week of the PhD. Alistair was like, right, can you please comment? And then I was like, in my first week of my second doctorate, do I really want to upset Richard Dawkins straight away? Can't we wait for like a little... Thankfully, the pandemic hit and had better things to do than discuss that. It's really interesting because so far in that discussion, you had feedback from lots of theologians, and what they, like Alistair would argue, is that Richard Dawkins is not consistent. So when he argues that theology is evil and God is pretty much like a virus in the mind, you need to be more rational and get rid of all that weird thinking, he doesn't apply the same kind of thinking to his own thoughts. So that's the one bizarre thing that most people point out quickly. And of course, I can look at viruses and go like, wait, that metaphor is like really not helpful, because viruses are quite different in the way they interact. They can also be beneficial. There's a lot around viruses that Richard Dawkins' metaphor falls short of. And of course, we can talk about it for hours, but like basically, I'm looking at the metaphor and go like, you know too little about viruses. You're not taking into account the biological knowledge you have about viruses nowadays. Sorry.
So you still come to the same conclusion?
Yeah, conclusion is the same. I'm just coming from a different angle.
Well, let's talk about that, because your PhD is looking at how viruses influence theological discussions. So I'm aware you're doing a whole PhD in this on top of your full-time job. But let's, if you could, in a nutshell, would you be able to just summarise how looking at viruses can actually inform the discussions that we're having in a theological setting?
Yeah, absolutely. So there are certain features of viruses that I think are really interesting. And so I look mainly at conversations about, of course, suffering and what we do with that theologically. And I think when you look at viruses, this becomes more complex as there are many aspects of suffering that are very subjective. So if you look at the big picture of things, it is complex because different parts of ecosystems benefit, others don't. So I think we're looking usually from a very anthropocentric perspective on the suffering. And even within humankind, we usually look at my suffering. When I complain about suffering, I'm complaining about my suffering. I don't care about yours. And I think that is something we need to get out of that discussion, that it's a complex picture and it's a big story. We are part of ecosystems, we are part of creation, we are part of a big story. And just because this is currently bad for me doesn't mean that it takes away the benefit for the whole longer story. It doesn't justify it, and I'm not saying suffering is bad even if it's just me. But I think there's some humility we need to learn about our place in creation from this. I'm also looking at good and evil, and that connects usually with, like, what do we think about viruses? Are they evil? Yes and no. The short answer is I would say no, because of the different functions they have in different parts of ecosystems, the benefits they bring to things, how they've shaped the planet that we live on. And there's so much they do, and I can't go into much detail here, but it's amazing, literally, the ways our bodies function, the way this planet looks like, the diversity of species we have. We wouldn't have any of that if it wasn't for viruses. The planet would look very differently and might be better or worse, who knows, but it would be very different. So if we say this is beautiful or this is amazing, viruses were part of that. Another discussion I usually look at is human identity, because we were shaped through an evolutionary process that was also driven by viruses, and not just because they integrated into our genomes and we are now making use of the genetic material they left behind, but also just because when they infect us, yes, they put pressure on our immune system, but they also put pressure on all the rest of the cellular machinery because they're using it. Our cells try to evade and the viruses readjust. We try to evade and they readjust. So who we are as human beings, by coming out of that evolutionary process, how we connect to the rest of creation is something you can discuss with viruses. You can define life or think about how do we actually define life. We define viruses as non-living because they don't have their own metabolism. They always need a host. They're literally just a piece of information. Quite an amazing piece, because then a lot of stuff happens. But where do we draw the line? And is it not artificial to draw the line between viruses and bacteria? Because now, the last 10 years, we found these giant viruses that are very complex, and they have so many gene products. They barely need any help from the host. They still need help, but barely. And then we have these bacteria. The majority do really well without help. But there's a bunch of bacteria. They're also lacking gene products, and they need a bit of help from the host. So why is that line there? And why do we call that alive? And why do we call that bad? That dead? And isn't there so much more to life? So I think there's a biological discussion about how do we define life, but also probably a spiritual conversation of what does God call life? And what does life actually mean? Is there more to life than just a functioning biology? So I think there's lots of these conversations that we can have. And of course, we can go into eco-theology. Mm-hmm. How should we deal with our planet, with all the changes that are happening, and how that affects virology and then will affect the rest of the planet again. There's much about responsibility in that area. So I think there's loads of discussions that you can go through. It's a lot more than you can tackle in one PhD.
I do want to speak about the climate change things, because you wrote a really interesting article for ABC Religion, sort of looking at the similarities between coronavirus and climate crisis. But I was really struck when you talk about whether viruses are inherently evil. I think our kind of gut reaction would be to say, oh yeah, of course they are. They always, you know, you look at the coronavirus and think, of course it's evil. But you, in one of your academic papers, likened it to natural disasters, which I think is quite a helpful differentiation. So one of the questions that comes up a lot when we talk about suffering is, why would God allow natural disasters? Because in the same way as viruses, natural disasters, certain natural disasters are needed for the sustainability of the planet. But they still obviously cause a huge amount of pain. So how would you respond to that question about why God would allow viruses and natural disasters?
I think that's quite, that is quite a difficult one. And I think that's probably one that, that gets me most also personally. Because yes, I know a God who loves this planet and loves me, and he doesn't like suffering. And you can see that in the Bible, and you can see that he co-suffers. He suffers with people who suffer. And in the Bible, interestingly, most of the people in the Bible, they don't have a problem with the existence of God and suffering. They deal with it, and it's part of them, and they don't question that there's a loving God. And I think that is really interesting. How can you tackle that tension? When you look at nature, yes, it needed suffering for the diversity and to create that planet, but was that the best way to do this? And I think that's the main discussion amongst theologians who study animal suffering, that there are voices who ask, well, if God knew where he wanted to go, if he wanted the diversity of pelicans and fish and humans and different birds, why couldn't he have he created them all in the first place? And there are some process theologians who argue, well, if God thought having values like freedom of development in evolution and the process of going from one species to the if that's what he did, he must have assumed that that was the best way. And so they call this the only way hypothesis. But it does only work if you also have redemption as part of that whole package, because if God is a loving God, he needs to find a way to redeem this and to make up for that suffering. And so there are some theologians who would say that the new heaven and earth that we're waiting for only works and only comes into place because we've gone the long way. And if we didn't experience the suffering, we wouldn't have values like compassion, because if there's no suffering, you can't be compassionate, you can't be gracious. And I think that's a really interesting concept, because we like these values. We think they're very godly to express these things. There are, of course, people who question, like, you know, was that necessary? They have some interesting thought experiments. As a biologist, I would argue there's a lot more to the biological process that we, I think, still underestimate, and that's not just creating you and me the way we are, but it comes with a history that we carry with us. And some people know epigenetics. It's basically the way your genome is packaged, carries around both happy memories from past generation as well as trauma. And I think there's a lot happening in the evolutionary process that we don't understand. I don't understand why God allowed suffering, I'm honest, and I don't like suffering, no one does. But I do know God well enough on a personal level that I trust that he'll find a way to redeem this. And I think that is, that's quite satisfying on an intellectual level without being able to explain it. And I think what I learned from virology is to hold these things together. I see the complexity and the beauty that suffering can still bring in the natural world. It brings me humility because it shows me where my place is. I'm part of creation. I'm not disconnected from all the other ecosystems, both through the history of coming from them and being connected with them through the viruses that can cross species barriers and ecosystems. And at the same time, knowing that there is a God who doesn't just laugh it away. He takes it seriously, and you can see this in the Bible, where he both does not just use suffering as a punishment. There are lots of incidences where he deeply suffers, co-suffers with suffering, and he's not taking himself out of the equation. And I think that's the beauty of Christianity, that you have a God who comes into the world, becomes part of that suffering, and takes it upon him as well. And I think that is... I think that's very moving, and I think that holds it together for me, being able to hold it both and keep that tension and live with that.
I suppose that's where the academic theory becomes pastoral as well, isn't it? That you've got to hold the two in tension.
Yeah.
I mean, you mentioned the suffering occasionally being a punishment from God, or people perceiving it to be. One of the questions that has come up time and time again in an incredibly insensitive way around viruses, perhaps the HIV virus, is could this be a punishment from God? How would you respond to that question?
That's a good question. Of course, I don't know what God's planning and what God's intentions are. And of course, I do believe in a God who does interfere with the world, probably not on a daily basis, because he has given us lots of intellect to handle things ourselves. He has given nature the freedom to develop. There's natural laws, which basically means we've measured often enough to understand how certain rhythms work, and they usually do work that way. But I also do believe that he interferes. I think I would never go as far, and that's mainly a pastoral reason why I would say that, I would never go as far as saying this certain thing is a punishment from God, because I think that would claim that I understand what God's plan is, which I don't. What I can say, though, is I think what we see from natural disasters, viruses, there's certain responsibilities that we have, and with both HIV and coronaviruses, we have not dealt well with the natural world, because the way we keep animals, for example, fosters viruses jumping across species. For HIV and other viruses, there's a certain behavioral risk factor, and of course, if we would behave in a safer way, we wouldn't have the risk factor. But at the same time, I think especially this coronavirus pandemic, even if it's not a punishment from God, I think it does show us certain things where we fall short, and I think that's something to look out for. And I think in this pandemic, we've seen the areas of life in this world that we usually don't pay attention to. We've seen who the marginalized are, and this should actually show us where we should do better as society. And I think now that we're slowly overcoming the trauma of this pandemic, I hope that we're coming back to these conversations of who are the ones suffering most in society, because they were affected most and they were pointed out to us. Can we actually make use of that awareness now?
One of the things you mentioned when you were talking about suffering is that we often say, why am I suffering, or why are my friends suffering, that anthropocentric approach to suffering. Why, in your opinion, does a virocentric perspective on suffering actually really help when we're talking about these big theological questions?
Yeah, I'm not sure if it helps for everyone, but it put my perspective, I think, into a better place. Because I was looking at the grand scheme of things, I can look beyond time scales, I can look beyond my own little world, my different ecosystems that I'm a part of. And I think it helps me to see a fuller picture of what God created, and I think that's amazing. I can see both the suffering and the beauty, I can see the developments and the problems. And I really like that, because I think it is a more realistic perspective of God. God's creation than just my little neck of the woods.
Thank you for listening to Unapologetic. I'm Ruth Jackson, and as always, you can find out more about our guests through the links with today's show. We would love to hear your feedback. Do drop us an email with your thoughts at unbelievable@premier.org.uk, or get in touch via social media. And don't forget, there are more shows, articles and resources at our website, premierunbelievable.com. You can also register there for the chance to win a free book. That's premierunbelievable.com. And if you enjoy listening to Unapologetic, please do consider rating and reviewing it. Thank you for listening, and see you next time.
You've been listening to Unapologetic. For more shows, resources, and our newsletter, visit premierunbelievable.com.
Since 2016, the Premier Gospel Awards has celebrated the heart and soul of gospel music. Now, in 2024, powered by Compassion UK and live from London's iconic Royal Festival Hall, we're bringing you our biggest and best show yet. Join us on Saturday, September 21st, for an unforgettable night of special guests and live performances from the biggest names in the UK, USA, Africa, and more. Last year's event sold out fast, so don't wait to grab your tickets. Buy now at premiergospelawards.org.uk. The biggest ever Premier Gospel Awards. It's the culture. It's the message. It's the music.